And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. Today is a special Inside Scoop, I think, where we walk back and try to figure out how the Bush administration may be putting tentacles into the current Obama administration. You may have read in the news that Attorney General Designate Eric Holder, at least for today, will be voted in on Monday, and it's largely expected that he will be voted in by quite a large margin. And perhaps the reason for that is because, well, there's really not much opposition to Eric Holder, mostly because, well, he's not that controversial a guy. He is a ex-judge, an ex-prosecutor, someone who's highly respected in the Clinton administration. And I should say, by the way, also that he got a 17-2 approval rating in the Senate Judiciary Committee. So the question is, why did we wait till Monday? You may recall that the ranking Republican of the Senate Judiciary Committee is Arlen Specter, and he requested the delay. Now, why would he request a delay when he plans to vote for the guy, and Orrin Hatch plans to vote for the guy, and Senator Sessions of Alabama, a conservative, very conservative guy, plans to vote for Eric Holder? The excuse couldn't be that they need to find out more about the Mark Rich pardons, because after all of that information is already known, has been known for the last 8 years. So what's going on here? Why would they delay Eric Holder becoming Attorney General 1 week when they've really got nothing to complain about? This isn't like Timothy Geithner and the tax problems. What's going on here? Well, as my soon-to-be guest has done a lot of research on, her name is Marcy Wheeler. She is her website is emptywheel.firedoglake.com. She's been studying how all of this relates to illegal wiretapping by the Bush administration. You may recall, I did several programs on it when it was reported, that the United States Attorney General was John Ashcroft, and was in the hospital for gallbladder surgery several years ago when George Bush wanted to reauthorize an illegal wiretapping program. You may recall that the Deputy Attorney General Comey was in charge at the time, and then White House lawyer Alberto Gonzalez, later Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, was so anxious to approve this illegal wiretapping program that he tried to go over the head of the acting Attorney General, who was Comey, and went into the hospital room of then Attorney General John Ashcroft and tried to convince the man, drugged up after gallbladder surgery, to approve the illegal program. Ashcroft, who had approved all kinds of surveillance, apparently felt this one went too far, and even in his drugged state said no, at which point Comey and the leader of the FBI threatened to resign, finally causing Bush to back down. Why does any of this matter? Was it an attempted illegality that went away? Well, apparently, at least for a few days back in March of 2004, it was absolutely clear that the Bush administration had no authority to surveil without a warrant. But it appears they've been doing so anyway. It appears that there's a case right now before a district judge in San Francisco, Vaughn Walker, precisely on this point. And it appears that the delay of the approval of Attorney General Eric Holder may just prevent this judge from looking into Bush illegalities. Lots and lots of stuff is going on. And to explain the details, I have invited Marcy Wheeler to come join us. Marcy, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much for coming on. So take us back in time, if you will, to where this all began. I assume it's not just related to the illegal memorandum that then White House lawyer Alberto Gonzalez tried to get John Ashcroft to approve. That's part of it, but it's more than that, right?
Yeah, what we know happened after Ashcroft refused to sign that is that Bush reauthorized the program on his own accord, and the only legal support he had for doing that was Gonzalez's own signature. And remember, back then, Gonzalez was White House counsel. So it was basically the president saying, oh, gosh, I'll get my own personal lawyer to sign off on this, as if that makes up for the attorney general not signing it. And there are a couple of reasons
time,
to believe
just to be that clear. I just want to be clear. At that time, the Attorney General, John Ashcroft, refused to sign. The Deputy Attorney General, Comey, refused to sign. Number three, the Solicitor General refused to sign. Nobody in the Justice Department would sign on to that memo. Is that right?
Nobody in the Justice Department would sign on to that memo.
Okay, go on.
And so then Bush reauthorized it, and we know that the signature on that memo was White House counsel Alberto Gonzalez, which isn't what it appears, even according to Bush's own standards, they needed to approve the program. They needed the attorney general. As it turns out, what they did was use three or four different areas of the law to authorize this whole thing. One authorizing the foreign surveillance, another authorizing surveillance of Americans, and the part that they say gave them the ability to spy on Americans required attorney general signature. They didn't have it. They were doing it with the White House counsel.
Okay, take me back a little bit beyond this. We have a lot of time. We have a full hour to discuss this. So I want to really set the stage for people to understand how this conflict began and why, again, the delay of Eric Holder was so important in it. But let's just start at the beginning. After September 11th, 2001, the president was determined to spy on Americans, not foreigners, but Americans without a warrant, right?
Right. What he did was say, I'm spying on people in foreign countries, and oh, by the way, while I'm doing that, I'm also spying on Americans who happen to be having conversations with foreigners or who happen to have email on the same server as people we think might be part of Al-Qaeda.
And to be clear, these are not necessarily only non-citizens, you know, Americans that are not citizens, immigrants living here. This would be, you know, true red-blooded American citizens as well, correct?
No, absolutely not. I mean, we know since the Obama administration started, Russell Tice, who was a whistleblower from NSA, has confirmed that actual journalists were separated out, but still wiretapped 24/7 so that they would have journalist communication. So we know it was not just ordinary citizens. It was even journalists who presumably are supposed to be able to protect their sources, not under the Bush administration. Didn't happen.
Okay, so Bush is determined to do this. He and Cheney and Rove get together. They decide it's a good idea. John Ashcroft was attorney general at the time. Presumably even he thought to some extent it was a good idea. What do? They issue memorandums after September 11th, right?
Yeah, there's a memorandum, for example, that they basically said, because we're in kind of a state of war and the president is the commander-in-chief, he can go in and search, say, an apartment building and detain everybody in that apartment building and question them and hold them as long as he needs to question them. And that's a memorandum that we know they used to authorize the going in and searching of email servers. So it's the same theory. They're going into an email server, as they argued they could in an apartment building, and detaining all of the emails in that server and not giving the emails in that server the appropriate, you know, protection from search and seizure, and they're looking in your email. And
clear,
based
Marcy,
on that...
I should say, to be clear, this is done without a warrant from a court, without a warrant even from the secret FISA court. No court is looking at this at all, right?
Correct.
Okay.
And so,
is this a John Yoo memo?
That's actually is that a John Yoo memo? A lot of them were John Yoo memos. I'm not entirely sure whether this was not just John Yoo. It was also another of the lawyers in the OLC, but... it's one that Chairman Conyers, for example, has really been pushing to get released. It has not been released publicly yet, but he released a description of what it was in this giant report that he did a couple of weeks ago. So we know that they basically said they could go into an apartment building and detain everybody for questioning without a warrant. Same logic, they could go and detain everybody's email.
And was this Office of Legal Counsel memo approved by then-Attorney General John Ashcroft?
Yeah, in theory, although we know that he wasn't allowed to get his top advisors read into the program. He wasn't allowed to talk to people who know about these technical issues. So they basically showed him very little about the program and made him sign off on it. And to his discredit, he did. And that's how the Bush administration, you know, kind of justified wiretapping Latin Americans.
Well, now this is very interesting, even from the outset, before we get to today, and we've, like I said, we've got some time, which is why I want to go through this chronologically. It's easier to understand that way. Attorney General John Ashcroft, who is not exactly known to be a great civil libertarian, this is a man who defended a lot of the Patriot Act seizures and letters and without giving people a right to go to a court. He's not exactly a great civil libertarian, but even Ashcroft was cut out of the loop of what his own department, the Office of Legal Counsel, is under the Justice Department. He was cut out of the loop, or at least his advisors were cut out of the loop, as to what his own department was doing.
He was not allowed to get his top advisors briefed on the program. And, in fact, we know that then-Deputy Attorney General Larry Thompson, so this is the guy before Comey, we know that he was cut out of this loop. And then, even though he was cut out of the loop, asked to approve some of the wiretapping that was going on under it. So they were cutting out the very top levels of DOJ and refusing to let them know what was going on in this program.
And we know this now because of Conyers investigations or through court actions or both or something else too?
Yeah, we know it because of – a lot of it is because of Jim Comey's testimony. A lot of it is because of the writing of people like Barton Gellman. A lot of it is because of little bits here and there that have leaked out. A lot of it is because of some of, you know, Conyers' investigations. He even had you in to testify. So it's leaked out over time, although we still don't know exactly what they were doing with the information from Americans. We have just an outline of everything that they did that they used to authorize the program. Another thing we know that they did was say that they could, that the president could kind of pixie dust away his executive order. So he had an executive order that Ronald Reagan wrote, and he basically just changed that without changing the writing of it so that we American citizens couldn't know that he had changed the executive order that said Americans could not be targeted.
Back up here 1 second, because this is an interesting point. There's so many interesting points here. I just want to underline the ones that really strike out. Ronald Reagan signed an executive order way back during his presidency that said that American citizens could not be surveilled without a warrant.
That's arguably what the Constitution says. It basically
says
that.
Well, I think so, too. But,
but apparently
but I want to know what that meant, what Ronald Reagan said.
Well, Ronald Reagan said was that Americans weren't going to be subjects of intelligence investigations unless there was approval from the Attorney General. And he basically left the understanding that even if you were overseas, you would not be targeted. And what Bush did was go to John Yoo, get an opinion that said, you can disappear your own executive orders or prior president's executive orders without telling anybody. You can just kind of in your own little brain say, I'm changing that executive order, but I'm not going to tell anybody that I'm changing it.
So,
and we know he did it with this particular executive order.
So, Marcy, I think what you're telling me is that Bush signed secret executive orders that undid Ronald Reagan's executive orders, but he didn't put them in any – I mean, when the president signs an executive order, even secret executive orders, there's an official thing. You sign it, it's an executive order, and it has a number and everything like that.
The way that opinion, which tells him he can pixie dust this stuff, is written is it says if he violates his own executive order or an existing executive order – it is as if he modified the order, but he doesn't have to sign anything. There's nothing in writing. He can just, it can be in his brain, in thin air, in George Bush's little pea brain, and that accounts for changing the executive order. They also did this, I mean, just as a sidelight, they also almost definitively did this with the law, the executive orders on classification and declassification, and that's part of how Dick Cheney outed Valerie Plame. But, you know, it's this whole pixie dust notion which says, I don't have to tell you what I'm doing, and I can just disappear existing what has the force of law by just wishing it away. And that's the force of law.
To be fair to George W. Bush, he's not the first president that thought of this. I'm reminded of the Frost-Nixon interviews where he asked Nixon, can the president break the law? And Nixon says quite clearly, if the president does it, it's not illegal. It's that same theory, right?
Well, yeah, except these are also executive orders. So this is kind of the president's own guidelines for people in the executive branch. So, but the other time when they did use this kind of pixie dusting of executive orders was in Iran-Contra. And so Reagan himself did this and kind of pixie dusted executive orders limiting what he could do on intelligence programs. So there is a solid history of pixie dusting executive orders so as to be able to abuse power.
You know, pixie dust makes it sound so cute. Well, what we're really saying is the president is saying, I'm above the law. Whatever I do, I don't care whether there's an executive order or any other illegality. I can simply do as I please. I'm the president. Go away. And my people can too, I guess.
And I don't have to tell you.
And I don't have to tell you that I'm even doing it.
This is what I'm doing. But I don't have to tell you.
I break the law, and I don't have to even know I'm breaking the law or care that I'm breaking the law or tell you that I'm breaking the law, because once I break the law exists no more.
Yeah.
Okay, just so I'm just clear. I want to be clear about this. So this idea that you call the pixie dust idea, that I call the above the law idea, was that at least written down? John, you wrote a memo saying if the president breaks the law, it is the law no more. Is that at least written down?
Well, it's the executive order, so I should be, really clear. It's not laws that Congress has passed.
I understand.
Executive orders that the president has passed, but...
Right.
That is written down. We haven't seen that. We have not seen that opinion. Senator Whitehouse got one line from that opinion declassified in December of 2007. So that's how we know. And when Whitehouse declassified that one line, he made it very clear that that was part of what Bush had done to kind of justify this illegal warrantless wiretapping program.
Now, did you write this memo in the latter half of 2001 after September 11th, or is that much later?
I assume you wrote it because it's the kind of crazy thing he would write,
yes.
But you never know. And presumably it happened in October of 2001 while they were thinking up ways to justify wiretapping Americans with no warrant. So,
Marcy, by the way, I have an embarrassing confession to make, one that my listeners know but you may not know. I went to law school with John Yoo. He was in my class. I remember trying to argue with him at that time about various amounts of the law, and he didn't feel that he ever had to justify his point of view. And that was true in law school and even more true today. I just – a little side note. I can't help the fact that I was in a law school class with him, but anyway, let's move on.
No,
it's not my fault, please.
Sorry.
Okay, so they do these initial things after September 11th, these memos. They're sort of – Ashcroft is cut out, but he approves it anyway. And does Congress know about this?
No.
Not at all. Isn't even that they tell four people, nothing.
They did. They told four people, the then leaders of the intelligence committees in both the Senate and the House. They did not tell, as they are legally bound to, they did not tell the entire intelligence committees, and they didn't even tell the leaders of Congress and the Senate. They just told the intelligence committee leaders themselves, the chairmen and the ranking members. But we know from what they have, these people, it was Nancy Pelosi and Bob Graham at that point were the Democrats, and we know what they have leaked out is that they weren't given really good descriptions of what was going on. Who knows? Maybe they're just CYAing, but, they did do a briefing in 2001, and they did briefings for just about every 6 months until they broke another law, which is when the Senate tried to defund this kind of data mining of Americans in 2003, and then they stopped doing briefings again for a little while. So
Okay, so Pelosi, as I recall, said back at that time, I'd love to tell you what they told me, but they won't let me tell you what they told me because that's classified.
Right. Okay. And you know, that one of the things that went on in these briefings, we know there's this famous briefing they did on March 10th, 2004, which Alberto Gonzalez has kind of said, well, I can tell you what we said, but I won't let them tell you what we said. And he has repeatedly asserted under oath, and Dick Cheney has asserted not under oath, that everyone approved, that Congress said, go ahead, illegally wiretap Americans. We're great with that. But we also know that Alberto Gonzalez took notes from that meeting. Well, he didn't take notes at that meeting. 2 days later, after they were already in trouble because Jim Comey was no longer having anything to do with this, 2 days later, Bush told Gonzalez, write some notes from that meeting. So write your own version of what happened in that meeting 2 days after the fact.
So
that we can come back and say, yeah.
Very cool. Now back up. Before we get to 04, I just want to follow the transition from 01 to 04. There was a Senate bill to stop this data mining in 02. Tell me about that.
The Senate twice, and I think the first one was in 02, but there was one in 03 in particular, where Congress passed, and the Senate vote on it was unanimous. They passed on funding. They basically passed an amendment that said you cannot use any of this money for total information awareness, for anything like total information awareness. You can't do it. It was passed.
And the president signed it, and it became law.
Yeah, and what's really interesting about, well, the president signed it but wrote a signing statement, you know. So, again, this is one of those moments where the president kind of – he used everything on this program. But to go back to when they passed it, I don't know if you recall, but Jay Rockefeller, who was then the ranking member – he was then the ranking member on the Senate Intelligence Committee, wrote a note to Dick Cheney after the second of these briefings that he received. And in the note – he basically said, Dick Cheney, this is total information awareness. You know, I'd like to go get in. They did the same thing with Congress. They said, you can't talk to any Bureau aides. You can't talk to anybody who knows about the technical issues. But Rockefeller wrote this letter to Dick Cheney and said, this what you briefed us on today is total information awareness. That was the day before the Senate passed by unanimous vote this amendment that says you can't use any money at all to do total information awareness on Americans. So we know that in Jay Rockefeller's mind, and he was, of course, the only person in the Senate who's briefed on this, what he was passing that day made this program illegal. But then by the time it got passed both houses of Congress, Bush signing statemented it away, and I forget the exact words he used, but he said, poof, you know, yeah, whatever.
Okay, so so here we have September 11th. The president's advisors, deep in the bowels, John Yoo and others, without telling Ashcroft but getting him to sign on, signed this stuff, total information awareness, spying on Americans, really at will, as much as you want, journalists, citizens, doesn't matter. They inform very few people, and when they do inform the Democrat, Jay Rockefeller, of the Intelligence Committee, he the next day gets the Senate to unanimously unfund this. The president signs it into law, puts in a nice little signing statement saying, I didn't mean what I just did. Now it's clear, at least as of 03, that they're breaking the law, right?
Should be. I'm presuming they used a lot of money to pay those telecom companies to wiretap us. But, yeah, presumably
okay.
As of that point, I mean, above the fact that they aren't allowed to wiretap Americans in the way they did, above the fact that they were disappearing their own executive orders. Now you've also got something that specifically says you cannot use DOD financing to wiretap Americans.
And to be clear,
that's like three or four levels of illegal at this point.
Right. And to be clear, as everyone knows, it's not just the Constitution. This is a congressional law which trumps all executive orders. The president is free to do executive orders within the interstices, if you will, within the holes, the ambiguities of what Congress does. When Congress says you can't do it, no presidential executive order can trump that. That's just law 101, I guess. All right. So in 03, Congress says don't do this. The administration keeps doing it. What is the big deal with what happens on March 10th, 2004?
Well, one of the things that we think happened in the interim, in addition to Congress defunding it, one of the other things that happened is the court that approved these warrants was beginning to sniff out that the Bush administration was wiretapping Americans, figuring out what they wanted to get a warrant through this FISA court for, and then going and getting the warrant. But the judges on the court were going, this stuff stinks, and started hassling the administration. So that's going on as well, you know, that the judges are beginning to get hip to what's going on, and they don't like it either. And so that brings you to December of 2003, beginning of 2004. You've got Jack Goldsmith, who's now head of OLC, and you've got Jim Comey, who's now the deputy attorney general. You've got two new guys in there. They're going, I can't believe the administration is doing this. And when the program comes up for its 40-day reauthorization that the attorney general has to buy off on, by that point, Comey has convinced Ashcroft he can no longer approve this program. And that's when Ashcroft goes in the hospital to have his pancreas.
And to be clear, there is some secret order. And the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court approves more than 99% of its warrants. I think it's like 99.4%. It's an astounding number. And the court is giving an inkling. This is a court that never says no. Is giving an inkling that they're figuring out that as you say, they're spying. The administration is spying on Americans, finding out information, and then backforming it through the court. In other words, they spy on you, they find something they don't like, and then they go seek a warrant on the court based on the very illegal thing they did in the first place. This court that never says no is starting to say no. The new people, as you point out, in the Justice Department are starting to say no. Ashcroft is in the hospital, and then comes the really quite dramatic events of March 10th, March 11th, that Jim Comey testified about. Give us the brief, Marcy.
The short version is Comey told the administration no, and the administration then convened this briefing with Congress. They were about 3 months overdue on when they should have done a briefing. And we don't know exactly what they said to Congress, but they basically tried to get Congress to say, okay, go ahead and wiretap anyway. And some of them may actually have done that, some of the people in the briefing. They also brought in Tom DeLay for a briefing the following day. Some people suspect that they did that just to get numbers up so that they could claim they had a majority of people supporting this. And then based on having spoken to Congress, even though most people, you know, the administration's version of that is not true, but based on whatever they got out of Congress, then
Congress, just to be clear, you're talking about 6 or 8 or 10 people, right? You're not talking about all of Congress. Okay, all right, go ahead.
8 people, and then Tom DeLay the next day by himself. But based on that, that gave them an excuse to go to the hospital with John Ashcroft in the ICU ward with his pancreas taken out, with he's doped up on all sorts of drugs. So all of a sudden, the president's office calls the hospital and calls Mrs. Ashcroft and says, you know, Gonzalez and Carter coming over. And when she gets that call, she then calls Comey and says, oh, my God, Gonzalez and Carter come over. And there's this great car. There's this, you know, Comey sticks the siren on top of his car. They race through the city. They need to get there before Card and Gonzalez because they're going to take advantage of Ashcroft. You know, he's 6'8" or whatever he is. He sprints up the hospital stairs. He gets there before they do. He gets Ashcroft somewhat coherent. They come in with the document to sign, and Comey's sitting there at the bedside beside Ashcroft. And then
right, I was going to say, this could be in The Godfather Part 4. I really think they're going to have to make a movie on this, but please, go ahead.
Yeah, and so, you know, there's the car scene chase, and the bad guys come into the hospital room thinking they've pulled a fast one on Jim Comey, and then John Ashcroft kind of rises out of his ICU bed and says, I'm not the attorney general he is, and points to Comey, meaning you can't come to me and try and get by Comey. He's the guy in charge. And so he doesn't sign the document. And there's a big stink, and they make Comey come to the White House, and everyone at the Department of Justice prepares to quit. when Alberto Gonzalez tells this story, he wants to point out that the next day is when the Madrid train bombing happens. So he wants you to remember that terrorism is still out there. Of course, you know, Spain got hit because they went to war with us to Iraq, which wasn't part of against terror, but regardless.
And there's no evidence that American journalists were part of that bombing in Madrid, but anyway.
Yeah. And then we know that on the 11th, having not gotten a signature from the Attorney General or then acting Attorney General Comey, Gonzalez signed the document himself. That's when Comey threatened to quit. And they eventually came to some, basically on the 12th, Bush said, okay, we'll put it right. We'll fix it. But we know for at least that day, and probably for the Senate Intelligence Committee has said that it was a period of not more than 45 days. So it's, you know, it could have been up to 45 days when they were not only wiretapping on Americans, but they were wiretapping without the approval of the Attorney General that they themselves said that they needed. And what's interesting about that is that according to FISA, you can be punished for every single violation of FISA that you do. So you can be punished for every single time you wiretap an American without having the proper warrant. The statute of limitations for that is 5 years.
And let me back up just real quickly, because I've told our audience this before, but just in case anyone doesn't know all the details, FISA is the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. It was became law in 1977. And it became law largely because of the abuses of J. Edgar Hoover in spying on Martin Luther King. And it was passed at that time, and it was designed to be the sole way that you could have a government that does a warrant that does a surveillance without a warrant. And they set up – that's when they set up the secret court, the FISA court, and they did that so that they could still follow the law but allow it to be in secret when it was necessary. So this is the whole structure, and that's what Marcy's talking about. That has a 5-year statute of limitations.
Right. And so, you know, we don't actually know what went on after 2004. We know that people were still going to Eric Litlau and James Ryson from the New York Times, who eventually broke this story in 2005, with concerns. And it was probably people close to the FISA court. It was probably people, we know Pam, I think his first name is Thomas Tam, who was at DOJ, he was raised in this FBI family, and he was freaking out because it's, you know, you can't do this go-around of the FISA court, which they were doing. So there were people from all parts of the government that were beginning to freak out about this, and even as late as 2005, they were still freaking out about it. So whatever James Comey got the administration to do in 2004, it wasn't enough to alleviate the concerns of all these people who were still going to New York Times journalists in 2005 and convince them to break the story.
And to be clear, Marcy, we don't know what happened on March 12, 2004, after this incident, how Bush resolved it in a way to get Comey not to resign and the FBI director not to resign. We don't know exactly the fix, do we?
We don't know that information. We don't know... I mean, they presumably did some fix in 2004. And then after 2005, when it all became public, the administration tried several different means of doing this. And eventually in 2007, they were forced to go to Congress and get something passed through Congress. So, there were probably four different attempts to put this on legal footing. And, you know, up until August of 2007, they didn't have any approval from Congress. They had a very bad law from August of 2007. They had a less bad but still bad bill from 2008, and that's what they're relying on right now. And that's the one that now President Obama voted for last year. So
let's back up. August 2007 to February 2008 was what's called the Protect America Act, right?
Right.
Okay, and that's the one that the president said, look, I'm in desperate need. I've got to have this right away. There are terrorist attacks. And Congress said, look, we don't know if you need this or not, but we'll give you 6 months just because you say you need it, and it's the August recess, and we're going to give it to you, but we're going to review it in 6 months. It was August 07 or August 06. Something makes me think it was before the elections, but you may be right that it was August 07.
No,
Protect America.
I think it was 07. Yeah, it was 07.
Okay. All right, it's 07. All right, anyway, they said we've got to have this, and so they said, all right, we'll give it to you, but it's going to come up in 6 months. And then it came up in 6 months, and by then Congress had studied this thing carefully. You may remember the administration insisted that this thing was going to expire, and they would have no authority again, and everything would be terrible. And Pelosi basically said, "Well, let it expire. We've got the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Don't worry about it. We've got this. You didn't need this to begin with." And then they came up with this compromise before the elections, the one that said that the telecom companies that did this would get immunity in the past, but it wouldn't be authorized for the future. And that's the one, the compromise that Obama and others signed on to.
Well, they get immunity for the future too. So long as, I mean, and this is the dreadful thing about it. So long as the administration says we need you to wiretap on Americans, that immunity is now written into congressional law. What was really controversial about the bill, for good reason, is that Congress was also saying understand that the administration used that piece of paper signed by Alberto Gonzalez on March 11th, 2004, and went to telecom companies and said, okay, keep wiretapping on Americans. And, you know, it's not like telecom companies don't have lots of money that they spend on lawyers. And in spite of all that money they're spending on lawyers, they still accepted this document that didn't fit the rules that they have to know whether or not they're allowed to wiretap Americans. So, I mean, they basically just overlooked the fact that for some reason, all of a sudden, the documents that they were getting were signed by Alberto Gonzalez. And yet we are close to giving them immunity for having wiretapped on Americans, for having, violated all the rules about protecting Americans' privacy. And going forward, we have no protection either because, there's this immunity written in. So, maybe Obama won't abuse power as much as George Bush did, but we just got to trust him for that. And the next time we have a George Bush, he can ask the telecom companies to do whatever he wants to do, too.
I'll tell you, my understanding is slightly different than yours, Marcy, but I'll be happy to look up the bill. My understanding was that it retroactively approved what was done in the past, but it did bar it for the future. But you may have studied this more than I have. Let me ask you this, though. The one thing that's very important, though, is that the Attorney General of the United States has got to sign off on the program, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So if the new Attorney General, if Obama's Attorney General, which we all expect to be Eric Holder come Monday, doesn't sign off on the program, it can't happen legally.
Right. Right.
Okay. And there was a court case that's been – actually, there have been several court cases on this. Bring us up to date on when the first court cases were challenging this, and then take us up to Judge Walker's current case.
Yeah. I mean, there were court cases immediately after this was first revealed in 2005. So starting in January 2006, everyone was filing court cases, and one of the first ones to get – ruled on by a judge here in Michigan, the program was ruled illegal. The problem being that one after another of these cases has been thrown out because nobody could prove that they were wiretapped. So every time you get before a judge or before an appeals court, they say, unless you can prove that you were wiretapped, then we don't have to listen to this court case.
And not only can you not prove that you're wiretapped, but it's illegal to tell you if you've been wiretapped. So in other words, you can't prove it, and if you could prove it, it would be illegal, so they could put you in jail for proving it, because you're not allowed to have that information.
Right.
Nice catch 22.
Right.
You're not allowed to have the information, because that's a violation of criminal law, and because you don't have the information that you're not allowed to have, you can't challenge it.
It's Kafka. You have no way of protecting yourself, even though, for example, Lawrence Wright, who wrote The Looming Tower, he knows that he was wiretapped, but he doesn't have any way to go sue them for it. So he's just got to, they were even going after his daughter, and he's just got to suck it up, I guess, even though he knows that they were wiretapping him because he was researching, you know, Osama bin Laden's family. So that's the catch-22 we're in. All of the extant cases got consolidated and put before a judge in California, Judge Bonwalker, who there's one case that is different from every other case, and it's called Al Haramain, which is a Saudi charity, and that charity and it did legitimately have some ties to people who had some ties to 9/11. So it is an organization that the Justice Department at least declared to be tied to terrorism. But what they were doing was wiretapping not just the Saudis overseas, but they were wiretapping the lawyers, the American-based lawyers who were defending these Saudis overseas. So, you know, the Bush administration threw out the notion of attorney-client privilege a long time ago, but these were the charity's attorneys. And in the course of defending the charity, they were given this log of calls that, by all appearances and by all descriptions, proved that they were illegally wiretapped, proved that on a certain number of occasions that the government had wiretapped them, the American lawyers in the United States, while they were talking with their clients.
And one of the fascinating things that you wrote on your blog, Marcy, was that one of those dates that they were wiretapped happened to be the date that everyone agrees, including the Bush administration, it was illegal to wiretap. That March 10th date, when the drama in the hospital occurred with Comey and Ashcroft, was one of the dates that these American citizens were illegally wiretapped.
Yeah, what Judge Walker forced this charity to do, because it's the same catch-22, they gave the document back. They gave the proof that they were wiretapped on back to the government because the government said, top secret, you can't have it. So they gave it back. But then they tried to sue, and we're in this catch-22 area where they don't have the document anymore. They know they were wiretapped, so how do they prove it? And last summer, Judge Walker said, okay, you've got to come up with some way using unclassified sources to prove that you were wiretapped. And one of the things that they did was go into their notes from having talked to their clients and said, you know, on such and such a date and such a date, we talked with our clients. And as you said, one of those dates, and remember, these people have seen the logs, so presumably they know precisely what dates they have to say. And one of the dates that they say they were talking to their clients and believe they may have been wiretapped is that March 11th, 2004 date. So, yeah, it's in fact that they know that they were wiretapped on that day, it is a coincidence, presumably, but it also happens to be the day that we know the program got reauthorized without the Attorney General's authorization.
And the reason why this Saudi charity is the one case that's going through, other than some, you know, far more severe cases, I mean, that case at least there's an ostensible connection to terrorism, as you point out. You have lawyers defending people who may have had some connections. The only reason we have this one, rather than the guy writing about Al-Qaeda, the journalist you're talking about and his daughter and everything else, is because they accidentally saw this log that they really didn't have a right to see in the first place, right? There's pure accident?
Yeah, DOJ screwed up and gave them proof that they had been illegally wiretapped.
And it just pure, you know, if they hadn't screwed up, then they wouldn't have even this case.
Yeah, exactly. And so they're the only ones in the country right now who have any chance of proving that they have standing, that they are an aggrieved party that was illegally wiretapped on under FISA. But
okay.
They're at the point now, and this is where the court case is now, where the judge has said, they submitted their case and said, look, we were wiretapped. And then on January 5th of this year, Judge Walker said, you know, they're right. They've proved that they really are aggrieved parties. So I want you to give me the log. I want you to give me the document. I'm going to look at it. I'm going to determine whether or not they really were wiretapped on. And if they were, we're going to move forward with this case.
And so finally, after 4 years of challenges, this mere accident by the Justice Department means we might have an actual legal case challenging FISA. So what is the what did the outgoing Bush administration, now we're talking this month, January 2009, but prior to the inauguration of Barack Obama, Bush's lawyers were scrambling, I presume, in the Justice Department.
Well, they waited until the last minute, and then they scrambled. They Walker wrote he released his ruling on January 5th, and basically what his ruling said was, you're going to give me the document, and we're going to follow certain procedures going forward, all of which still, you know, respect the notion that this is classified information. He basically said, I want you to figure out whether you can declassify any of this stuff. But he didn't say, I, as a judge, I'm going to unilaterally declassify everything. All he said was, I'm going to take a look at that log, and if it shows that they were actually wiretapped, then we're going to start talking about how we litigate this case where all of the information is classified. But based on that ruling, that what the administration did was on the 16th, so this is the Friday before the end of their term, they told the appeals court that they wanted to appeal. And then on the 19th, you know, the Al Haramein lawyers, meanwhile, are saying, you know, we need to give the judge a statement about what we're going to do. We need to give, you know, and the Bush lawyers are kind of ignoring them. And then at like 10:56 on the 19th, on the Monday before Obama became president, it's the Sunday before. That's when they first tell Al Haramein's lawyers that they are going to appeal. And that's when they first get around to telling Judge Walker that they're going to appeal. So they waited literally until, you know, less than 48 hours before the end of their term to put this through.
And so who may not know the law, when you appeal a judge's decision, that doesn't automatically stay or stop the lower court from enforcing its decision. In this case, Walker, the district court judge, said, give me these logs, and then I'll determine whether or not the Al Haramein lawyers, the people who think they were unjustly wiretapped, have a right to sue and go forward, hand it over to me. And then they appealed the decision, but that doesn't stop the district court from going ahead and enforcing its decision unless they get what's called a stay. Now, here's where it all gets very, very interesting. Take it away, Marcy.
So this is, and I'm going to have to, so Obama becomes president on Tuesday. And then on Wednesday, when you and I were together on the Hill, that's when John Cornyn said, hold on, we've been looking at Eric Holder's nomination to be attorney general for over a month now, but I'm gonna ask for another week to figure out whether or not Holder can become attorney general. And so that was on Wednesday the 20th.
Which the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, Patrick Leahy, said was unprecedented, that they would use this obscure rule to delay things a week, particularly when no one seemed to have a problem with Eric Holder. He was approved 17-2 just recently by the Judiciary Committee. The Mark Rich stuff has been known for 8 years. Nothing new came up there. They're asking it to delay a week when they really have no challenge to Eric Holder. What's really going on, Marcy?
Well, and then on Thursday, the same lawyers who have been arguing this case for George Bush put in a filing under Obama's name saying, yeah, we support what the Bush administration did. And it's not really, you know, if Obama really opposed what they did, he could go, you know, he could really escalate this.
He could fire them, I guess.
He did not do that. He could fire them, although if he fired them, how long do you think it would be until Kit Bond was screaming Saturday Night Massacre?
Maybe so. But now these lawyers who are the same Bush lawyers that have done everything before but are technically working for Obama come January 20th and don't have a new attorney general to report to. I guess Mukasey's still the attorney general of the United States, right? I mean, Eric Holder has not been confirmed yet.
Yeah, Mark Phillip is now, who is the deputy attorney general. So Mukasey's gone, but Mark Phillip, who was a conservative judge out of Illinois who became deputy attorney general a couple years ago. He's the acting
attorney general, and he's a Bush appointee and is solidly with Bush and solidly against disclosing this information and so forth.
And one of the interesting things about this is the Al Haramein lawyers were like, look at what Obama's own nominees have said, and they looked at something that Eric Holder had said in a speech. They looked at, so he's going to be Attorney General. They looked at something that Don Johnson, who's going to be the new, presumably going to be the new OLC head, and this is the person who writes all of the opinions that you and I have been talking about.
He's taken over for John Yoo, basically.
John Yoo is never as senior as she'll be, but she's going to clean up after John Yoo, yeah, and she's going to clean up after Stephen Bradbury, who's been doing what John Yoo used to do, which is, you know, write these crazy opinions. So that's her thankless job. But we know that she is very critical of the Bush administration's stance on the unitary executive, on this kind of all-powerful, the president can do whatever he wants theory. So we know she's going to be critical of a lot of the things that they did in that guise, one of which is the notion that says the president can classify or declassify with no limitations whatsoever, even if he's trying to cover up his own crime. One of the things that the Bush administration is doing is anytime that, you know, they've got crimes or potential crimes or alleged crimes, they keep invoking state secrets. You know, it's too secret for you to know, so you can't have the document. Therefore, you're never going to prove in a court of law that we broke the law. And that's what they've been invoking with this log that proves that the Al Haramein lawyers were wiretapped.
As of last week, Bush is gone. Obama's president as of Thursday the 22nd. And yet the lawyers who, as you pointed out in your blog, originally wrote this thing under George Bush's name and literally had to change it the last minute to put Obama in, these same lawyers are seeking a stay from the appellate court to prevent Judge Walker at the district court level from finding these logs that could actually let the case go forward. Can Eric Holder, once he becomes Attorney General, can he undo this? Is there a chance the judges will rule before he can? What does the delay of Eric Holder actually accomplish for those who are opposed to us finding out about this?
You know, I think that Judge Walker is stalling at this point. He's got another opinion that he needs to write, or not opinion, he's got another ruling on the retroactive immunity as well. And that's been pending for a while, and he doesn't seem to be in a big rush to write that before the Obama administration comes in. So, you know, given that
Walker knows the games they're playing, and he'll just wait until Holder's approved and then allow the real Obama administration to make these decisions. In other words, you don't think this little stratagem of the Republicans is going to succeed?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, how long is it going to take Eric Holder to get up to speed? How long is it going to take Don Johnson's approval to go through? How long, you know, we know yesterday that Kit Bond held up, Kit Bond and Arlen Specter especially, but especially Kit Bond, who is the ranking member of this Senate Intelligence Committee right now. He admitted straight up his two concerns were whether or not the Obama administration is going to pursue torture charges against Bush and you and Cheney for authorizing torture. And he also said that he's worried about whether or not retroactive immunity will go through. He's worried about whether any charges on these issues will be going through. So Kit Bond came very close to breaking the law yesterday when he said, I'm holding out approving Eric Holder until I get a promise from him that he's not going to bring charges against any Bush administration officials, which is crazy.
You can't say to the Attorney General designee, if you don't change the law, if you don't refuse to enforce the law, I won't approve you. But as I recall, it was reported, I think, on MSNBC, that Kit Bond said that Eric Holder privately promised him that he wouldn't prosecute the Bush officials, to which Eric Holder pretty immediately said, I didn't say that. Right?
Right. And what Eric Holder has said repeatedly is no one is above the law. He has said that if people have, and this is actually, you know, something that Mukasey has said too, but if somebody who is an interrogator had a, you know, was told, and I mean, and the interrogators were never allowed to see these opinions, but if an interrogator was told, we have an opinion that makes waterboarding legal, then Holder's not going to go after the interrogator who made waterboarding legal or, you know, claimed to make waterboarding illegal. But, you know, Holder has, I mean, and you know, I don't guarantee that Holder's going after this. I think the chances are actually fairly slim for a lot of political reasons, for a lot of timing reasons, for on the El Haramain, on the five-year statute of limitations, on the actual FISA violations. There's no way he'd be able to put together an indictment, you know, even if he had that El Haramain document in hand, that's proof that after Bush authorized illegal wiretapping of his own accord on March 11th, 2004, it takes more than 6 weeks to put together an indictment of a former president. You just don't do that quickly, right? It's probably over. I mean, I've had some really smart lawyers who say, well, but for the cover-up, the conspiracy to cover up their illegal behaviors, you could still indict them. So,
right,
you know,
that's what they did to Richard Nixon. Remember, they never proved Richard Nixon ordered the Watergate break-in, but they did prove he covered up the Watergate break-in, which turned out to be just as serious. To be clear, though, the statute of limitations, the reason why it's running out, because it's a five-year statute of limitations under FISA. This happened in March 2004, March 10th, I guess. So it begins to run March 2009. Though you had in your blog something that could happen as early as February 19th of this year. What's that?
Oh, no. That's the earliest. The dates that El Haramain gave that said they were talking to their clients. And, again, I'm just guessing that they used those dates because they remember looking at the log and knowing that those dates were among the times that they were wiretapped.
Right.
But the dates that they gave in their filing started in February. Now, in February, the illegal wiretapping program was operating with Attorney General approval. But it still means they were operating without warrants when they were wiretapping Americans. I mean, there still is this larger question.
Right. And to be fair, even after whatever accommodation, secret accommodation, we still don't know, happened in March 12, 2004, there was still a very uncertain illegality from 04 all the way up to the Protect America Act, at least in 07. So that would extend the statute of limitations for that. The trick is, though, that this particular day, March 11th, 2004, for which it expires this March 11th, is a particularly easy day to prosecute because everyone knows there was nothing available that day. Now, it seems to me, though, Eric Holder or his designees, although they don't have a lot of time, could approve an initial indictment and then amend it later when they find out more facts. I think that's something that we could encourage the administration to do. Right, Marcy? You don't see any problem with that.
No, I think we ought to. I mean, look, and where I look at things, Obama has gone very aggressively after shutting down torture. You know, that's one of the first things he did after he became president. He hasn't said a peep about what he's going to do about warrantless wiretapping. And one of the problems that, you know, if people are concerned about these issues, one of the problems for us is we don't have four-star generals standing up and lobbying Obama to get rid of the torture system. We don't, I mean, the people we have backing us on this aren't four-star generals. And
we're running out of time. I got to tell you, this has been a compelling, terrific story. In 30 seconds, if you can. We've talked a lot about the warrantless wiretapping. Can we prosecute for torture? Is that possible?
Yeah, I think wiretapping is probably easier than torture. But, you know, people want to go after you for some of the crazy opinions that he wrote. And we know that, for example, they started torturing Abu Zubaydah before the first opinions authorizing waterboarding as, you know, whatever. So there are moments like that in the whole torture regime that we can go after them as well.
But I got to tell you, this has been a very, very full hour. No commercials at all. If you want to find out more from Marcy Wheeler, go to emptywheel.firedoglake.com. This is Mark Levine signing off.
Thanks, Mark.